Brenda, we always start at the beginning. Tell us when you were born, where you were born, and a little bit about your family and your community.
Sure. So I was born on July 18th, 1955, a birthday that I share with Jeff Reckenbach. The date, I don't think the year, but the date and the month and the day.
I've got a couple of years on you.
Brenda,
Oh, do you?
let me interrupt. I forgot the very important thing. This is Debbie Goldman. I'm interviewing Brenda Roberts. It is May 29th. Brenda is in, are you in Denver or a suburb?
I'm in Centennial.
Okay, she's in Centennial, a suburb of Denver, Colorado. Jeff Reckenbach is in Cleveland, as always, and Jeff will also jump in with questions as appropriate. And Hannah Goldman, our wonderful producer, is in Brooklyn. Okay,
We
let's start again. Tell
take
us.
turns with these interviews, and Debbie got the lucky straw this time.
I'm leaving all the technicians to Jeb.
Thanks.
Makes sense. So anyway, I was born
Even though
on
he
July.
was not, even though he was not a technician. Okay,
Okay.
starting again then.
Yes. So I was born on July 18th, 1955, in Dallas, Texas. My father was a sales rep for 3M. He was originally from South Dakota. My mom was from Minnesota. She was a government worker. She was a member of AFSCME. And when my dad, after they got married, my dad was transferred to Dallas. And that's where I was born. I have a sister who was 17 months older than me. She was born in St. Paul, Minnesota, and then two brothers, one Danny, who is 66, and John, who is 64. They were both born in Dallas, like I was.
And how long were you in Dallas?
I was there until for 11 years.
So tell us
So,
a little bit about the community in Dallas.
okay, sure. So we lived in Richardson, Texas, which was a suburb of Dallas. There were a lot of transplants. So we were in a neighborhood that was filled with kids and families that weren't originally from the Dallas area. So there was kind of a bonding, and it was just the best neighborhood to grow up in. The parents got along, the kids got along. It was really fun. I was raised Catholic, and I went to a Catholic grade school. And at that time, the focus in the Catholic Church, from my perspective, was service, inclusion, doing acts, good deeds, acts of goodness, and community. There were a lot of community events. There were a lot of things that we all did as a community to benefit others in our community. And that was kind of a foundation from, and a lot of the people in our neighborhood were also Catholic. So not only did we have a neighborhood connection, we also had a church connection. And like I said, it was just a really fun, positive environment to be in.
So, Catholic values and community were very powerful in your upbringing.
They were. Yep. Yep.
Do
I was going to say, I was in Dallas when John F. Kennedy was assassinated. I was 8 years old. We were drawing hand turkeys, and there was an announcement that came over the loudspeaker that the president had been shot. But my mom was Irish Catholic. My dad was German Catholic. But for John Kennedy to be elected as a Catholic was a very big deal for my family. Not just my parents, but my extended family. And he preached service, you know, ask not what you can do, what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. And we really embraced that as a family and as a community.
Are you still a practicing Catholic?
I am not. Nope, I am not. So many things in the church have changed. I think it's gone from an inclusive environment to an exclusive environment. And one of the things that drew me to the union was the values that I had experienced as a child and as a Catholic at that time, the union became what I remembered the Catholic Church to be for me.
Do you consider yourself a Southerner?
No, not at all. Never got the accent. It was really a short time. I loved the time, but you know, my parents grew up in the Midwest, and so I consider myself more of a Midwesterner than anything.
And those who are listening to this can hear that Midwest accent in your voice.
No way. I have not lived in the Midwest for 27 years.
I hear it. I haven't lived in Chicago for
That's true. You have a Chicago accent.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, sure, Brenda. Yeah, sure.
Hey, listen, you betcha.
Golly. So back to Richardson. Was this a integrated neighborhood? You were in the Texas during the civil rights era.
Yes, I was. I remember collecting poll taxes with my mom.
What?
We'd go, yeah, poll tax. My mom was, she would go and collect poll tax. That was, you had to pay taxes. And
poll taxes to vote?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And she would go to registered voters and collect them? Or this is for new voters?
I'd go with her. Yeah.
Door to door?
Door to door in our neighborhood. It was kind of like collecting for the American Cancer Society, right? So she had a designated area and she would go door to door and collect it.
Do you remember how much it was?
No, I just remember it was on pink paper.
Oh my goodness. And if you didn't pay, you couldn't vote.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you would just, my mom would mark down whatever and take it in. But you know, at that time, John Connally was the governor. It was very blue when I was growing up in Texas.
But blue in Texas in the 1950s is not what we think of as blue today.
No, that's true. But it was it was not Republican. It was not like the Republicans of today.
Was it a racist environment?
No, not at all. I have never heard my mom or my dad say, I'd never heard it. They're both passed now. They were people. That was it. There was never no derogatory remarks, no slurs, no nothing. They were just our neighbors.
And was it a middle class neighborhood, working people?
Yeah, it was a working class neighborhood. Very working class. Our school, it was integrated school. There weren't a lot of minorities. It was mostly predominantly white, but there were families, there were Hispanic families, there were Latina families, there were African-American families.
And that's in the Catholic school.
In the Catholic school.
Mm-hmm. So maybe this was not your memory of what it was like desegregating the schools in Richardson, Texas, because they had to have been segregated when you were born.
Yeah.
It took a long time to implement Brown versus Board of Education. So the 50s and early 60s must have been a period of a lot of. And do you remember separate signs for colored and for white?
I don't. Nope.
Okay. High school? Where did you go to high school?
So when I was 11, my dad got transferred. We went back to Minnesota. We went to Minnesota, and I went to a Catholic girls' high school. For the first 2 years, it was all girls, and then we combined with the boys' school. So for the last 2 years, it was co-ed. And I much preferred the all girls.
Really? Why?
Well, you didn't have to put makeup on or do your hair, you know, that kind of stuff. So, yeah.
I want to ask one more question about being Catholic. My experience is that people who were raised in the Catholic school system and as Catholics learned a lot of discipline and structure. Would you say that was something that then helped as union activists and leaders?
Yes, Absolutely. When I was in grade school in Dallas, when a teacher or a priest or a nun walked into the room, you immediately stood. And when I was 7 years old, I had a ruptured appendix and I was in the hospital for 13 days. And the principal and my nun, second grade teacher, came into the hospital room to see me. I had an open, they didn't stitch up my incision because it was getting infected. And I immediately jumped up because the two nuns came into the hospital
What a
room.
story.
Isn't that silly?
Yeah, and I guess I'd add not only disciplines and structure, but also an understanding of hierarchy and rules.
Yes, definitely.
Jeff is nodding. As I recall, Jeff, you were also raised one of your parents was Catholic. Am I remembering that right?
We were a mixed household, Irish
Uh-oh.
Catholic and German Lutheran. So,
Oh.
You got it all. And then, of course,
Yeah.
there's the guilt from whatever religion we're
Yeah.
raised in.
And my Catholic mother was the disciplinarian in the house. She was the one that laid the rules down. So,
Oh, yeah.
yeah.
Yes. Funny.
Okay. Anything you want to add about that period?
I don't think so.
Okay. Then, did you go on to college, Brenda?
I did. And then I went to a Catholic college, to the College of St. Teresa in Winona, Minnesota. And I got my education, a degree in elementary education.
Did you ever teach?
No, because I did student teaching, and but because at the time in 1977 there was a glut of teachers, and so I did not get a job. And so to pass the time until I could apply again for the next school year, I went to work at the phone company. And the job as a service rep paid so much better than what I would have made as a teacher that I just stuck with it.
Okay, and why the phone company?
So I had some friends who worked there, and they said, you know, it was a great environment. And like I said, the wages and the benefits were superior to even jobs that required a college degree.
And this was 1979 that you started at the phone company?
April 23rd, 1979.
Okay, so this is after the affirmative action consent decree. In fact, it's the year in which that consent decree is now, the oversight is ending. When you went to apply, was why a service rep job?
So I went in, I went to the hiring office, I met with Claire Vogel. She was the hiring manager, and I was a female, and she said, this is the best job for you.
Not an operator, a service rep.
A service rep.
Because you
Probably
had a
because
BA.
I think that's why.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about the work you did in 1979 as a service rep. Explain to somebody what the office was like, what the work was, how big was the office, etc.
Okay, so I the there were probably 150 people in the office. It was the business office is what it was called. When I got there, I was in training for 12 weeks, and then I went out on the desk and I had side-by-side training for about 6 more weeks, and then I was left to my own devices, and I did the job. There were no computers. Everything was on paper. We had the desk setup was there was a tub, a file cabinet, if you will, with all the paper records in it, and there were people on either side of that. So we had tub mates, and we would, if a customer called in, we'd get their phone number, and then we'd leaf through either, and we'd have to walk around the office to find which central office they were calling about. And then we'd go to that tub and we'd flip through until we found the paper record, and we'd see their name, their address, their credit information. And then we'd handwrite a note. Ms. Goldman called, will pay full amount of her bill, $16.32 on Friday by mail, and then follow it up. And then we'd write a little paper follow-up on a calendar that we had. And then we'd go back through and we'd look to see, okay, who do we need to confirm that we received a payment from? We also did, we were universal. So we also, not only did we do collections, we also placed orders for service, placed orders to disconnect service, placed orders to change service, and then just generally gave out information. Where can I get a phone book? Where can I pay my bill in person? Just, all of that kind of stuff. And it was considered like the primo job for a female at the time. And so the environment was fast-paced and very busy, but there was a level of appreciation for the work that we did. And at the time, we were the only game in town. There was no competition, and there was a guaranteed rate of return. So there weren't any pressures to sell different kinds of types of service and that kind of thing. It was really focused on providing the best service that you can to the customer. We could
So
take our time.
keep going.
We could take our time. I would get to know my customers. Oh, hi, Mrs. Smith. Yes. Oh, how's your son today? That it got to that level. And so I really liked the job.
You were servicing people in your local community.
Correct.
I
Correct.
didn't ask where this office was.
So it was in Little Canada, Minnesota, which is a suburb of St. Paul.
And you said that there were 150 people,
Yeah.
and this was a 9-to-5 office. It wasn't
It
after
was.
hours. And
Yep.
you
It
said it was you were a business rep. So
No,
is that
I was the residential rep in
okay?
the business office is what it was called.
Okay. And you got up a lot to walk around to get these pieces of paper. So it gave you a little bit of a chance to talk to your coworkers.
And like I said, it was very busy. There wasn't a lot of downtime, but if we were closed to make outbound calls, like if Miss Goldman didn't pay her bill and it came up on my calendar, I'd call and say, "Oh, did you forget to put that in the mail? Are you going to mail that today? Thank you very much." So during that time, there were minutes, you could get up and go to the bathroom. If somebody, we had clerks that walk through the office with their little carts and they drop off like new billing information, any information about changes to the job, if there was a barbecue coming up, if there were Girl Scout cookies being sold, that kind of thing. So there was time to connect with people, and I still am friends with some of the people I started working with in 1979.
Did you have time off the phone to follow up?
Yes. We would get, usually we would get a block of time in the morning and a block of time in the afternoon. Mondays, no. Mondays continued like just as they do today. They were very, very busy, but yeah. And we'd have one day for an hour every week. We would have a section meeting where we would meet with the people that were assigned to the same supervisor. We all took turns bringing treats. So you'd bring donuts or you'd bake brownies or something like that. And so we'd all get together one morning a week for an hour, eat snacks, and talk about what was going on in the office.
So you'd get to know the people that you were working with.
Yes. And you developed a relationship with your manager. So.
Did you have to ask for permission to go to the bathroom?
No.
And what kind of surveillance or monitoring? I think then you called it monitoring. What kind of
Yes,
monitoring?
there was oh, the only monitoring that was going on when I started was if a supervisor would come and plug in. So you knew the supervisor was there, and it really was more about improving your performance than trying to get you for doing something wrong.
Was there a lot of emphasis on quality?
There was. Yeah, there was. And along with that emphasis, there was no, yes, I want quality, but if you can't do it in 15 seconds, skip the quality and move on to the next customer. It really was about providing excellent customer service.
Do you have any anecdote to share with us that you remember about that?
I can't think of anything offhand.
Okay. And how long were you a service rep on the phones?
So I was a service rep until 1992.
Okay. So that was,
I mean, I kept the title. I held the title till I retired. But when I started getting active with CWA, first as a steward, then as an officer, then I wasn't doing the job as much.
Okay, so you were in the job during a period of a lot of change in technology. When did the computers come and what impact did that have?
Computers came in 1984. And so about 5 years after I started, and then we get the little black boxes that really business office, they were the BOSS system. Business office. Anyway, I can't remember what it was. But there wasn't a lot of change then. It was just a new way of accessing records and that kind of thing. The expectations, the quality was still very important. We just didn't get to run around the office as much because everything was right there on the computer. We still have downtime twice a day, usually, and we could still, you know, get up and walk around and stuff, but we didn't have the ability to go tub to tub, desk to desk.
As I recall, BOSS was a software that you used.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
And so it didn't change a lot. And did they consolidate the offices? Did they get bigger?
Yes. In fact, our office could only hold that many people. So they opened another office downtown St. Paul. And at some point, and I'm trying to remember when it was probably 1988, they tried splitting it so that some people were responsible for collections and some people were responsible for processing orders. And I stayed on the collection side.
Oh, wow. Did it work to separate the job?
No. Mm-mm. No, it really didn't.
Why?
Because people got bored with doing the same thing over and over and over again. It really curtailed the variety that was available in doing the work. And so a lot of people quit, and there was a lot of transferring back and forth. Oh, I don't feel like talking to this crabby customer. I'm going to send them over here, even though they probably didn't need to be sent. So there was just a lot of, I think it was the customers noticed it. The customers felt it. The quality of service that was being provided when they split really, I think, was diminished.
And did eventually the company reintegrate?
Mm-hmm. Yes, they did. And, you know, throughout my career, there was Universal. Then there was a separation into collections and orders. Then they went back. Then they specialized in, okay, you're gonna handle customers whose monthly bill is $50 or higher, that kind of a thing. So there have been all kinds of iterations.
When they split the job, did the company want to downgrade the pay of the collections people?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And did the union have to negotiate that?
We did. Yes. Yes.
And agreed to it.
Yes, and agreed to it. In the early 90s, I was still in St. Paul. A new vice president came in who had responsibility for residential service. And she decided that she wanted to create these teams of management and union to really do a deep dive into the functions of the job, the impact to the customer, and that kind of thing. And at that time, there was a lot of, like, nothing really came of it except they had downgraded the collections reps. And the only thing that came out of that joint labor management work was that the credit consultants got an upgrade, because we were able to show, I was on one of the teams, we were able to show that the work that the credit consultant did was equal to or greater than the work that the people doing the orders did.
We've jumped ahead a bit, but as long as you've opened this door, I'd like to spend some time on this. I believe this was the Jane Evans period.
Correct. Bunsen okay. Singles was the name of the program.
Okay, it's well documented for several reasons. One is there was Margaret Hilton wrote a report on this project for the federal OTA, something of technology assessment. And so she wrote it when the project was still operating and functioning. It's very positive. And I also recall that in the early Clinton administration under Robert Reich as labor secretary, they were promoting labor management partnerships, initiatives, collaboration, whatever word you want to use. And this was highlighted, and I believe your vice president, Sue Picha, actually spoke at a conference about this. So I want to talk a little bit about this. We'll come back to your work in the union.
Okay.
So we're leaving the timeline a little. We're in the early 90s. Do you remember the union's origins in reaching out to Jane Evans to try and change the conditions in the call centers at that point?
I don't remember a whole lot. At that time, I was a steward in the business office, is what we called it. And Jim Mahoney was the president of our local, and he was selected by Supisha to be on a EIQC, which is Employee Involvement Quality Council. And he needed to pick someone who was familiar with the work in the business office, because he was a tech and didn't have a lot of familiarity with that. So it was Jim Mahoney, Reed Roberts, Carla Floyd from Portland, and Randy Warner from Salt Lake City. And they each selected someone from the business office to assist them when negotiating with the company about changes that the union felt were necessary to improve the quality of the jobs for their union members.
And were you chosen?
I was.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
My understanding is that the individuals that you just mentioned were at a 1991, 92, then we called it the Commercial Marketing Conference.
Right.
And they got together and they all said, gee, it's so stressful in our call centers right now that conditions had changed from what you had described. And you can talk about that a little bit. And they came back and they did a mobilization. I believe they delivered balloons or something to Jane Evans. And they were surprised, but she came back and she said, okay, let's form a committee to try and improve conditions.
Yes, that's my recollection also, is that they were at a marketing conference. Their members were beating up these presidents to say, this is getting terrible. You know, this used to be a nice environment. Now there are so many productivity measurements. We don't have time to do anything. It's call after call after call. We can't get any vacation time. You know, all of these things that just made it very much like a sweatshop. And so these presidents were tired of getting beat up, And I don't know what level they had buy-in from at the national level for CWA, but they went, Reed was in Phoenix, which is where Jane Evans was. And so he had gotten to know her a little bit. And then he and Supisha reached out to Jane. And then Jane said, let's do this.
I don't think there was national involvement, is my understanding.
Okay.
And the other piece of my understanding is, while quality of work life and labor management had kind of died out in many of the districts, in District 7, it had continued. So you had somewhat of a framework, and that was also part of the background. So tell us about what you all did to try and work with management to make conditions better.
So we would visit offices, we would interview service reps, and we would interview those people that helped the process along. So we would talk to assignments. We would talk to
what
technicians.
Is assignments? What is assignments?
Assignments, they assign the pairs to provide the service, to connect the service to the customer's home. So the whole service delivery process was mapped out. And then along the way, we would talk to, okay, what's the roadblock here? What's the hold time trying to get through to assignments? What's the hold time trying to get, how easy is it to get to a technician if there's a last minute change? All of that kind of stuff. And then we would come up with solutions, the management team and the unionists, based on the unionist's experience in the delivery of the service and the manager supervising the delivery of the service. And some changes were recommended. Very little happened, unfortunately.
Why?
There, I don't think there was sufficient buy-in. And Jane Evans left shortly after the completion. And the person, it wasn't the person who replaced her's idea. And so it went up on a shelf, a very, very expensive shelf. Because the cost was, I mean, they flew people, we were flying all over the district to go to meetings. And there were all kinds of people who were off the job. One of the things I was going to mention is a lot of the noise that the service reps were barking about were, I'm trying to think, appraisals. And that nobody was meeting standards on their appraisals, and it was nothing but a deterrent to good quality service. And so Jane Evans said, okay, we're suspending appraisals. And at that time, it was all the measurements. And so when they suspended the appraisals, guess what? Calls went unanswered. It's like, woohoo! And so, you know, careful what you give them, because yeah, the quality of service really tanked because no one was held to any standards. So the pendulum swung way too far the other way. They should have stopped it in the middle.
And my recollection was when the union negotiated some bottom lines about the process that Jane Evans agreed to, no layoffs,
yes,
things like that.
Yes, no layoffs was a big thing, that there would be no layoffs. If this process resulted in streamlining of work, which would have possibly reduced headcount, the need for headcount, they wouldn't do it. They would place people in other positions.
So you don't think it made a lot of difference? What labor management joint programs is controversial within the labor movement. What would you say? Do you think that it turned unionists into collaborators with management? What impact did it have on the union?
I think that the effort that was put into it by both labor and management at the time the work was being done did feel very collaborative. And there weren't many changes, but it felt like there could be some changes. And so I think for a lot of people who participated, there was optimism. I think some of the changes, like the no appraisals for a period of time, that demonstrated to the rank and file that the union was working on their behalf. And so I think there was a benefit to CWA because we could demonstrate to the membership that the union did fight for them and did sometimes have a positive impact. But long term, for those that I worked with, they were always optimistic that there could be some positive change. And if management approached them and wanted to do things collaboratively, we developed like regional or district-wide committees around vacation time, around standards, measurements, and things like that. And so we were able to continue that at a more of a regional level as opposed to a district-wide level.
And you had a huge district. You mentioned that you were being flown around all the time. Did it help build relationships and unity among the
yes.
union, even though it was?
Yes.
And training of union leaders.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say, so for the unionists, the training that we got was amazing. And we were working with other local leaders. And so we developed a relationship with local leaders that we might not have had we not had the opportunity to work. So I got to know people in Seattle that I didn't know. I got to know people in Phoenix. And then we could network. Hey, are they doing this to you in your center? Are you getting this much time on your vacation calendar? So it helped us build a communications network that was really helpful. And then when management would come and say, well, you know, in Phoenix, well, I knew what they were doing in Phoenix because I had talked to Carla D'Amato and she said, hey, don't buy that. This, you know, so that was another real benefit for us as labor leaders.
And I do want to get on tape. You had a union consultant as well. Who was that?
Kevin Boyle.
Okay. Jeff, Hannah, any questions about this project before I move on?
This is right in your sweet spot. So, I mean, this is all yours.
Okay. Brenda, anything else on this? Otherwise, we're going to jump back.
Okay.
And you talked just quickly, you talked about that by the early 90s, the stress had increased, the productivity benchmarks had imposed a lot of requirements that induce stress, et cetera. Would you say it was because of the technology or the way the management implemented the technology and what was driving it, those changes?
So the word competition came into the vocabulary and the possibility that, because with the consent decree and the breakup, and then the next steps likely would be that no monopoly, we have to open our doors, we have to allow other companies in. And so then people became more aware of, hey, we don't have this guaranteed rate of return for much longer. So we'd better tighten up and make sure that we are getting as much productivity out of these workers as we possibly can. That, in my view, is what really drove it, not the technology.
Okay, so let's go to your union life. Not long after you started, you became a steward. Why did you decide to get involved, and what did being a steward involve?
So I got involved because while I really liked the environment, I did see where some people were in need of an advocate. Now, I never did. I got along just fine and all of that stuff, but I really did not appreciate how some of the managers were treating my coworkers, my friends. And so I got involved so that I could advocate for them. So it was really my first brush as a steward was on the shop floor. And I did not really go outside of that until we went on strike in 1983. So for those first couple of years, I really focused on representing workers and negotiating with management over like office rules, office policies, things like that.
Were you able to make a difference?
I'm sure I was.
I'm just wondering, do you have any particular story you want to tell?
Do. I have. There was a young woman. She was a couple years younger than me, and she tried so hard and did all that she could to meet to do a good job. But she was a single mom, and she had an attendance problem, and she was always getting in trouble for her attendance. And so finally, she thought, I'll just keep doing this because nothing's going to happen to me. And she was suspended. And so I had this heart-to-heart talk, and I said, it sounds like you have some issues at home, and it's hard to have issues at home and issues at work. So what can you do at home that will allow you to no longer have issues at work? And she got in touch with, I'm trying to remember the name of the organization. Anyway, so we worked together, got her in touch with like a backup babysitter, and she was able to kind of even things out at home so that it no longer had such a negative impact at work. And I think the advocacy that we did, I did, and that she did for herself turned things around. And she eventually went to management, but she stayed employed, which was great.
That was a challenge, wasn't it, with a female workforce, balancing
It
work
was,
and family.
yeah, yes, it was.
So, 4 years after you started working in 1983, this is 1 year before the big breakup of the Bell system. So, it's still the Bell system. And as I recall, the 83 strike was against AT&T, all of the companies that were part of the Bell system was a nationwide strike. And you were strike captain?
I
So
was.
tell us about that. What does a strike captain do?
So I helped with strike assignments. So we went out on strike. When you go out on strike, of course, you need to picket all of your work locations so that the company knows what's going on, so that we can be public facing about this. Hopefully, then we can draw some support from the public, from those who were getting service from Northwestern Bell at the time. And so as a strike captain, I was assigned a work location, which was the one I worked at. And I worked to assign picket duty to make sure people showed up, to bring treats, water, snacks, all that kind of stuff. To if anyone from the media came by, to direct them to our media person, and just to keep the morale up, because it's a scary time to be on strike. You don't know if it's going to end tomorrow or if it's going to end 6 months from tomorrow. And so keeping the morale up, keeping people moving, bringing the boom box so that we could play tunes and all that kind of stuff. It was very fun. It was one of the best. The 2 times we were on strike are two of my fondest memories of being a part of the union,
Why?
because the solidarity, you came together, you were fighting for each other, you were fighting for a cause. That feeling was amazing. and that everybody was working together. And you may have differences in the office, but when you're out on that picket line together and you're all fighting for the same goal, there's just no better feeling. It was just amazing.
Did you have scabs?
No. I was in Minnesota. Minnesota in the 70s and 80s, you didn't dare. When I in my whole time in St. Paul, I had one person who refused to sign a union card.
And at that point, you had agency shop, right?
We did. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And so when you picketed, I assume the business offices were also where central offices were. Were you keeping management, trying to keep management out of coming in to do your work?
We did. Yes. Yes. No managers crossed our picket lines. I don't know where they ended up because I was so focused on my little area, but no, we didn't have any managers cross the lines.
Do you remember what the strike in 83 was about and
wages,
how it was settled?
It was about wages and pension.
Jeff, were you on strike then, or what was your, where were you in 83?
I was on staff in Cleveland, and to tell you the truth, they all blur. I can't tell you one bargaining from another by the year. You know, I'd have to get some other milepost to be able to bring it back up.
I think being a strike captain for the first time, it for Brenda at least, it's yeah. A vivid memory.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Yes.
And as long as we're talking about strike in 98. By then, the employer is U.S. West. Is that correct? They've merged Northwestern Bell.
Mountain Bell, Pacific Northwest Bell had merged. We became U.S. West. In 1998, the big issue was overtime, that there were no caps on the amount of overtime that the company could mandate. And people didn't have any time with their families. So that was the biggest driver of the strike. And of course, wages, and of course, pensions, all the big three, healthcare. But it was mostly the overtime, that people just didn't have a life.
Was that primarily a technician issue?
No, it was everybody. It was the business offices as well, or the, you know, business.
Did you win some restrictions on overtime?
We did. We got a cap, 8 hours mandatory, 8 hours of mandatory overtime per week.
And the same in the service rep job?
Yes, the same in the service rep job.
Am I recalling that 98 is when there was the contested election between Larry Cohn and Sue Pisha for EVP?
Correct.
So that had an impact also on ending the strike, didn't it?
It did. Yes, it was. The timing was very unfortunate because the membership felt, I wouldn't say an absence, but a distracted leader. So I had just moved to Seattle in 97. I had transferred to Seattle in 1997. And because of the Bunsen Singles work back in the early 90s, I knew the officers in Seattle. And the president at the time was a gal named Patty Dempsey. And she appointed me to co-chair this whole strike committee. And so it was a great way for me to get to know people in my new local. And it was, again, like I said, one of the best experiences. The people, I worked 80 hours a week during that time because we wanted to make sure everybody had everything they needed. A funny story there is we had, I don't know if you know Freda McGrath, but she was from Ireland and she was just a feisty, take no prisoners, say what's on your mind person and very strong unionist. And there was a building across from our main building, our main Northwestern or Pacific Northwest Bell at the time, or US West at the time, that was going up. And Frida would go across the street to the tradespeople and say, come on over here, come on over here and join our strike and join our strike. And the foreman from the construction site called the local and said, if you have that lady in the red-headed wig come over to our building one more time, I can't promise that she won't come back to you in cement shoes. So, but it was a very, again, Washington was huge, a huge labor state, a huge labor community. And so we had all the support of the community. We did have tradespeople coming and walking our picket lines with us. It was just an incredible show of solidarity.
At that time, not the machinists, it was another union at Boeing that was very strong. The operating engineers, right?
The operating engineers. Yep. Yep. And the machinists and SPIA, which was the engineers at Boeing. They were very strong. So the machinists were 5,000, they had at least 5,000 members in one local, which was big in Seattle.
So you moved from Minneapolis to Seattle. How come?
I got married.
And started to have children?
No, I had children with my first husband. My second husband I met doing Bunsen singles. He was the local president in Arizona. His name was Reed Roberts. And we got to know each other. I was single at the time. He was single at the time. And we got to know each other and work together. And he went on staff and was assigned to Seattle. And we, after the Bunsen singles, we saw each other a few times and dated long distance for 5 years. And then we got married and I transferred to Seattle.
And you're still married.
And we're still married 27 years later.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Okay, so tell us, you were, I don't think I asked the name, the number of the local in St. Paul.
What? 7201.
And now you're in Seattle in local what?
7,800.
Okay. And you start to rise. Mm-hmm. EVP, local president in 2003. Tell us a little bit about what it was like to be local president. How big was the local then? How did you run the local?
Okay. The local at the time was about 3,000 members. So I had been the strike, I helped co-chair the strike committee, and I got to know a lot of people. And so I started building relationships and contacts, and I was a steward as soon as I got there. So I had built a stewards network. And then one of the structure at the time in Seattle was president, executive vice president, then two other vice presidents. One had responsibility for the US West contract, and one had responsibility for all other contracts. And the person who had responsibility for all other contracts transferred to, I think she actually ended up going to Minneapolis. And there was an opening, and Patty Dempsey, who was the president at the time, had the ability to backfill that without an election. And I was appointed to fill that position it was less than a year, which was great for me because I hadn't had a lot of experience outside of the US West contract. And so it really expanded my knowledge. And, you know, if you know how to represent, you can represent any contract really, but it helped me understand different contracts, get to know different people, that kind of thing. And so through that, then I was elected executive vice president, and that actually was my favorite job because if there was a lot of craziness, the president would handle it and I got to do all the other stuff. So, but then I ran for president. I was encouraged to run for president and I did. And I loved it. Not as much as executive vice president, but I did love being the president because I had such a great group of people around me. And I think you oftentimes will attract people similar to you in terms of values and the way you go about doing things and commitment and that kind of thing. So I had a great group of people around me, and we worked very well together. We developed decent relationships with management. I was able to be involved in a lot of the contract negotiations for the smaller units that we held, and I was able to do some negotiations on office policies and things like that. And I was able to mentor some of the newer union activists, which I really enjoyed. I think my teaching background probably came out a little bit.
What were some of the smaller contracts?
We had, so project labor agreements were big at the time, and we had smaller, like telecom providers who had to have union represented workers in order to bid for project labor agreement jobs. And so a lot of times we had managers who would talk to their members about, hey, these are project labor agreement jobs. They want union workers because it might be something that you would consider with your coworkers, so that we would have an opportunity at more work, which would keep you employed. So we had some of those. We have a group of taxi dispatchers at the Far West Taxi Company. We had a small healthcare group. I'm trying to think of what else. We had a bunch of them, but a lot of them were just smaller telecom.
So if I'm understanding correctly, this would be on public sector government buildings or whatever, and the telecom folks would be doing the wiring of the communication systems.
Correct.
Which in other areas, the IBEW might have claimed that kind of work. So this was different in Seattle than other places. Does that, and Jeff, jump in if I'm understanding it correctly.
Yeah, I mean, it was more than just government buildings. It was construction in general. And Seattle, I don't know where else this was going on, but in Cleveland, CWA was never able to be part of project labor agreements. The IBEW closed them out completely and did all the telecom wiring, you know, the pre-wiring that had to be done in construction. So pretty remarkable that 7800 was able to be a part of that.
Yeah,
I remember when I was, when George Cole was retiring from CWA, he made all of us in the research department review an agreement that had been made decades before with the IBEW to deal with these kind of disputes. Don't ask me what it said. I still don't remember. But I do remember, especially in New York, there were always these kinds of disputes. Interesting. Okay, so your local president, were the bulk of your members in the telecom technicians?
They were, yes.
So I'm interested in you coming out of the service rep, the business office, and a woman. How was it? Sounds like female leadership was not a new thing in Seattle, but talk a little bit about that.
So I will say this, there were a lot of technicians, but we also had small business reps, we had residential reps, we had CSTs, customer service technicians, which was inside work, SSTs, which was similar to that. Don't ask me what they did, I can't remember. But anyway, but in my work at the executive vice president level, I did a lot of second step grievances, and there were a lot of technicians who needed representation. And so through that, we had some technicians on our board, our executive board. And so I got to know them that way. I got to know a lot of the technicians doing the strike work. And so they knew me, they knew what I did, they knew the commitment that I had. And I think that's how I was able to get their support.
And you started your political work at this time?
I did. Well, so my very first political work was with Paul Wellstone. Remember him? When he ran for the first time, I know, I'd stand out on in front of our building with green balloons. He'd be with us. Anyway, but then, yes, then we started. I was on the legislative committee. Before I was the executive vice president, I served on the legislative committee, and we started building a committee. It had been pretty dormant to that point, and we had it pretty good in Seattle. It was a lot of Dems, a lot of people supporting labor just because of the community. And so I think that kind of took a back seat to representation at the time. But, you know, things were starting to change, and we recognized that we really needed to be more involved in like the Central Labor Council and getting to know the politicians who were going to have an impact. I mean, just stuff that we should have been doing or that should have been done all along. And so we kind of revived that, identified some people who could lobby. We had a state council, and a lot of our legislative and political work we did jointly with the other locals in Seattle and, I mean, in Washington, because so much of what we did impacted all of the different locals. And so we appointed a lobbyist, and our council dues paid for the lost wage time for the lobbyist. We started going to Olympia, which is where the state capitol was, building relationships with the locals. Patty Murray was a first-time senator at the time, Maria Cantwell. We had a female governor, Christine Gregoire. We helped get her elected. So, and then, you know, that gave us some clout with the company because, hey, we've got these relationships. If you're going to try and create negative regulations or remove any regulatory requirements, we're going to fight you on that. And so that helped us with our relationship with management too.
Do you remember any regulatory fights in Washington State?
Inside, we had a wiring. We had, trying to think of what it is. So we had a fight with the inside wire locals, the IBW inside wire locals. And we needed to get some legislation passed around the inside wiring. And that may go back to where, I'm sorry, I'm just kind of blanking on it right now. But it may be where, you know what it was? Certification. You had to be certified. Mm-hmm. And it would have cost the company a huge amount of money. So that's something where we did work with them together on it, that if you were already doing the technician work, you were grandfathered and you didn't need certification. So that was one, that was a big fight, and the company was very appreciative. I can't remember if we got anything specifically out of that from the company, but that was one.
I'm pausing because I had a question, but I can't remember what it was. Oh, LPATs. So we've talked with Annie Hill, we've talked to Louise Novotny about the creating of a national structure going down through the districts and the locals of the LPATs. And their recollection was that that was created around the time of the healthcare fights in, I think, during the Obama years. Is that right, Jeff? Are you remembering right?
It was around 2010.
Okay. Have been the Obama healthcare fights.
Yes. Yes.
So it sounds like before the LPATs, you really had an LPAT.
Yes, in Washington State, we did. But that wasn't true. And you know, we have in District 7, there are 15 states. And I think there are five that are blue, 10 that are red. And people in the red states would make kind of a half-hearted attempt, but a lot of the work that they did was not fruitful work. And so, again, they sort of pivoted to other areas that would have given them a bigger bang for the buck. So in Minnesota and Colorado and Washington, Oregon, what's my fifth one? Iowa was at the time. Those were fairly active. But, Arizona was very active too. And they had been for years. They had, Reed was very active, Joe Gosper, they were very active politically.
So you mentioned the big District 7, huge geography from west of the Mississippi and then to the coast of in Washington and Oregon and everywhere in between. Not only did you have red and blue states, you also had right to work and non-right to work states. I think the non-right to work states probably corresponded to the states you just mentioned as being blue. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, so you were then the District 7 LP coordinator at some point. I guess that's when you're still when you're on staff. So that's when you're on staff, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, so before we go to that,
okay,
is there anything more that we want to ask or you want to talk about of being local president before you go on staff?
I don't think so.
Okay, so when did you go on staff?
I went on staff in January 24th of 2007.
And who was the vice president then?
Annie Hill.
Okay. And what were your assignments?
At that time, I had responsibility for the public sector in New Mexico and Arizona and Iowa. Shared that responsibility with Bonnie Winther in Iowa. And then it was all non-phone company work. I had a small local of healthcare workers in Pueblo, Colorado, but mostly it was mostly public sector workers.
And at that point, you moved to Denver?
I was in Denver. So in 2000, Reed went on staff in 2004, and I stayed in Seattle because I was still the local president. And then at the end of my term, I transferred to Seattle, and I was going to retire. And then Annie asked me if I would work on a union management project. And so, and the company would fund my position. So I stayed as a credit consultant doing this job until the end of 2006, and then Annie asked me to join staff in 2007.
What was that labor management project?
It was doing analysis on grievances and mostly that, and streamlining it, what the major issues were. It was almost like preparing for bargaining and just pulling data out.
I'm confused. A labor management project around grievances?
So it was Annie and Mike Lynch was the manager responsible for labor relations. He needed somebody to do some work. And so he went to Annie and said, can Brenda do this work? So it wasn't really labor management. It was really he just needed somebody to do this work. Knew that I was going to transfer to Seattle or to Denver and what my background was and thought I would be a good person to do the work that he was requesting. And so I did that for about a year.
You want to say anything more about it? It sounds odd.
It was odd. And I only did it part time. And at the as we were getting towards the end of the year, I said, you know, this doesn't make sense. I really don't understand why you're having me do this.
And by now, the major bargaining unit in District 7 has, with what once was US West, has now been through how many mergers or purchases?
Okay, so US West, then Quest. So all three combined to the US West, and then US West was sold in 2002 to, and it became Quest. Phil Anschutz bought it.
Big change.
Big change, big change. Distancing. With every merger, there was increased distance between managers and union. And that was deliberate. Okay, we don't want to get too close to these people. Let's now this is another opportunity. And you know, we saw creation of unit bargaining unit, not bargaining units, work units that came in because Quest didn't just buy US West, they had also had some assets around the United States. They had long line, and so they had data centers and things like that, none of which were union. And so when you've got work
I'm
100, oh, can
sorry.
you
I've
break?
got Hannah. Is the background noise coming through?
I don't hear anything. Is it from where you are?
Yes. Hold on just a second.
Okay. No, okay. Oh, okay. Thank you.
Okay, sorry about that. You were right in the
Okay.
middle of a sentence, so start the sentence again.
What I was going to say is, so when Quest acquired US West, they also had other properties, and they were non-union. And so, you know, you go from a US West, which is probably 80% bargaining unit employees. Now you bring in these non-bargaining unit employees, so the percentage decreases. They like that they don't have to deal with unions anymore over here. And so, you know, that's their attitude, and it's very evident. They became more difficult to bargain with. Negotiations broke down, of course, morale. And they were on the verge of bankruptcy even after. And so they use that too, you know, hey, we'd really like to give you all of this, but we just can't because we're about to go bankrupt. And it's kind of been that way ever since.
And there was corruption involved, wasn't there?
Yes. Saul Trujillo. Yep.
And as I remember, there was also when a company prepares for being sold, they stop investing. And
Yes,
your,
yes.
particularly your rural areas, they just let the network
They suck all
deteriorate.
the yep, they suck all the assets and leave the rest. Joe Nacho was the CEO at the time, and he ended up going to jail.
So that's the environment in which you now move on to staff, right?
Yes. Woo-hoo.
Okay. You were LP coordinator on staff as well. Now we have the period of the LPATs, right? Do
Right.
you want to talk a little bit about that and how do you convince locals to get create legislative political action teams and how do you get them engaged and get the members engaged in the political work?
Yes, I think the LPAT structure was excellent. It gave support not only at the national level, but also at the district level and at the local level. It provided training, it offered some economic resources so that people could be off the job on lost wage time that was subsidized by the LPAT budget so that they could build committees, that they could visit, meet with legislators, They could support legislation. They could go to the hills, the various locations to lobby. It was really, really good. There was a constant stream of information about priority CWA issues, like the Affordable Care Act, anything that was related to work that was done that supported the work that we did. Speed Matters, that was huge. That was for people to be educated around Speed Matters. It helped connect the dots, because I think a lot of times our members think of the union as an insurance policy or something they go to when they're in trouble. And to be able to illustrate for them that it goes, unions go way beyond that, and really some of their most critical work is in the legislative and political arena. And by being able to attach something that's relevant to the work that they're doing in the field, help them I see how that's important. And it also helped us bring people in who might not otherwise have gotten active politically. So I felt like it was a great program.
What was Speed Matters?
I don't know.
Okay. Do you have an anecdote to tell us about seeing the light turned on for somebody about political activity?
I can tell you about a technician and Speed Matters. So we were at a district meeting, and we were at the district meeting in general session, and we had been talking about Speed Matters. In fact, we did a presentation on it. And afterwards, I had a technician from Idaho, of all places, who came up to me and said, "Oh my God, I have to be involved with this. I need to learn all that I can. I want to." And at the time, they had a state council in Idaho, but there were three locals. They were not very active. He then got so excited about that and started joining. We had district-wide LPAC calls. He started joining the calls. He started learning about the other issues that were relevant. And he went back and lit a fire under the locals in Idaho. And they were active, continue to be active. They not only got active around issues, they understood that the people that they elected would have an impact on that. And guy's name is Jeremiah Cleaver. And to this day, he is the local president in Boise, and he is one of the strongest advocates for legislative and political work in a very red state.
And why did Speed Matters turn him on?
I don't know for sure. Just that I think he saw it as a way to encourage US West, Quest at the time, to stay up with technology, to understand the importance of speed to their customers, and that it was a product that would sell, that would keep them from bankruptcy.
So I have to push one more time. I think you're talking to me, and you know that I know the answer to the question, but you're talking to people who don't know the answer to the question. What was the Speed Matters campaign about?
The Speed Matters campaign was about a minimum standard for up and down.
For universal broadband. For high-speed broadband to everywhere. That was in 2007 that the campaign began. We're now almost 20 years later, and we're still talking about the need to get high-speed broadband, especially to the rural areas served by the arenas of District 7. You had a lot of rural areas in your district.
Yes, we do.
So that turned him on.
It did.
Okay. When you were vice president, then you joined. Well, let me stop. Jeff, you have any questions?
No, not right now. But I think you did touch on when you talk about Jeremiah And it was exactly what you described. It was sort of a bridge, I think, between his union work and the work that his members were doing. And it was a way for them to connect more directly to our legislative political work. I mean, all too often we're talking about issues that a lot of our members don't relate to, and it's hard to make that connection. So if you use that as the bridge to get them involved in legislation overall, I think that's a very powerful and useful tool. So kudos to him and to the whole LPAT program for building that bridge.
I agree.
So now you're on the National Executive Board. Well, wait, I have one other question. In our interviews, some of the people we've interviewed regretted going from local president to staff, and some loved doing it. What about you?
I liked both. I really liked being a local president. It's almost like going from eighth grade to, or from middle school to high school. We're in middle school. The last year of middle school, you're the top dog. And then you go to high school and you're like the new kid. So it was a learning curve for me because it's a totally different job, I think. But I liked it. I really did. It took me just a little bit of time to transition from local president to being on staff, but the worldview that I had on staff, I really enjoyed knowing more about what was going on in the district. Not that I didn't, because as a local president, you pretty much do, but yeah, I liked them both.
Okay, you're now a VP on the National Executive Board starting in 2007. Do I have my time right?
As a vice president?
Yes.
2015. I was on staff in 2007.
Okay.
And then in 2015, I was elected to vice president.
When you got on the National Executive Board, how many women?
Let's see. Seven.
Okay, so it's you.
So it's Linda Hinton, Brenda Roberts, Lisa Bolton, Carolyn Wade, Vera McCall, and Anitra Sessions. Oh, and I forgot one, Sarah Nelson. So seven.
Did you mention Annie?
Annie wasn't on.
Oh, she was.
She lost that election.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
Yeah.
So this is after the diversity seats. So by then,
this is after.
So by then, the board is no longer the white men. It's a diversified board.
It is.
Okay. Quite a change. So talk about some of the main assignments and achievements that you had while you were, and learnings while you were at the national level.
I really enjoyed my time on the executive board. I feel like the people that I served with were very focused on doing what was best for the membership while also maintaining the health of the structure of the organization. We had some economic challenges and some of the decisions that were made around funding for some of the projects that would allow us to continue to provide the necessary resources to ensure that CWA was working optimally was a great achievement, I think, for our board. I was the e-board chair of the customer service committee. And with my background, I was really passionate about that. I was able to lead a delegation to Manila and the Philippines, where we met with call center workers to talk about the challenges that they were facing some of the workers had been instrumental in supporting the Verizon workers who, when they were on strike. And so to hear those stories, it was really interesting to hear from them, their fear that their work was going to go to a lower cost provider. And it was something that I took, there were four customer service workers from CWA who accompanied me. And so they could really relate to, okay, that's how we feel about you. And now this is how you're feeling about someone else, about that work going away. And it just illustrated that the quality of service was not in the equation of any management. They really just cared about getting the biggest bang for their buck, going to the lowest common denominator, making sure that it was profits above people, for sure. And we talked about some of the work that was being done by CWA in the United States around improving the work life of customer service workers and ensuring the security of the information that was provided by the customers that they were serving. I also went to we were deep in attempting to organize T-Mobile workers, and I had the opportunity to go to Germany and attend Deutsche Telekom shareholder meeting, and was able to speak with the CEO about neutrality during the organizing campaign, which of course he said, oh yes, we're so close in reaching an agreement on this. And then of course we never did.
What year was that?
That was 2016.
Okay. And Deutsche Telekom owned a significant part, or owned all of T-Mobile.
T-Mobile, yes.
And so both of those are really interesting international work of CWA. Let's spend a few minutes on that. First, the Philippines. So by now, the U.S. Telecommunications companies are offshoring a lot of customer service work, including Philippines at that point is not only for communications companies, but it is the largest offshore location for U.S. companies. I think about 1 million call center workers in the Philippines. So our members, one could say, are just pissed. Our work is going to the Philippines. We don't have solidarity with them. So talk a little bit about CWA's strategy. Why were you reaching out to Filipino call center organizations and workers? And what was the strategy there in terms of our own strategy to try and protect work?
So the strategy was, if we organize the unorganized, such as the workers in the Philippines and Malaysia, we can raise the standard, right? If they're organized, if they can negotiate, then the gap between the wages and benefits in the US becomes smaller, and it's to our benefit because, you know, we can talk till we're blue in the face, but if the employer can get the level of service that they're willing to accept from a lower cost provider, then that's what they're going to do. It's going to save them money. It's going to look good to their shareholders. So we wanted to, you know, it was enlightened self-interest. If we can level the playing field, then is it likely that they'll continue to offshore the work? That was one of the main things.
So you got that. How did you communicate that to the members?
Pretty openly. Pretty, you know, let's talk about this. It's the same strategy that we use in the United States with non-organized workers who are not organized yet. You know, we want, instead of bringing us down, we want to raise them up. And so when we would have conversations, when I'd meet with the customer service units, when we'd have conversations about them at district meetings, even back in the local, it was, as I said before, enlightened self-interest. Yes, we want to do what's best for these workers, but, you know, let's protect our own work. Let's make sure that we have access to these good paying jobs. And we want to make sure that they can't use the fact that they're lower cost in order to say, so we're not going to backfill over here. We're going to start going over here.
Did you see any of the light bulb moments occur? And talk about that for our members.
Yes, I did. I saw that. We had a AT&T mobility meeting. And like you said, the workers in the Philippines, they do call center work for all of the major telcos. They do for all of the major banks. They do for like travel. If you have a question with a travel agent or an Expedia or something like that. So AT&T Mobility, in the early stages of organizing this one particular group in IHX, we were talking about the work that was being done in the Philippines, and someone that was in that group said, well, can this work go to the Philippines? And yes, it can. And she said, well, but if we're organized, if we form the union, if we agree to be part of CWA, then I see that that would make it more difficult, that before we would get laid off, that at least they'd have to negotiate that there would be, you know, benefits to that kind of thing. So that illustrated to her the benefit of being represented by a union, not just in her work group, but if the others, as we talked about in the Philippines, were organized and had a contract, there that would offer them some protection, and it would likely bring things up to a more even playing field.
So this is pretty recent, and you mentioned IHX workers. Who are they?
So the IHX workers are a group in AT&T who, it's in-home experts, so it's a subset of customer service. Their higher-end workers or customers are sent to them for personalized, customized treatment. The company argued that they were exempt, that they were management. CWA argued that they were represented. It was a group that could be organized. CWA won. And so efforts have been underway since probably 2021 to organize that group.
And it's call center work? I thought they went door to door. I'm wrong?
IHX, it's both.
Okay. And as my understanding is then, the organizing is taking place district by district or state by state even. Okay. Okay. And let's go to the T-Mobile. That was also a very unique kind of strategy for CWA. CWA represents AT&T Mobility, dating back to getting the card check neutrality, and it expanded as the mergers occurred. But Verizon Wireless, for the most part, is not represented, and T-Mobile was the third, and then they brought Sprint, so they really are only the third, but owned by the Germans, where in Germany, the union represents Deutsche Telekom workers, but not in the U.S. So what was the strategy there? How was the global alliance fostered?
So the CWA recognized, again, if AT&T Mobility is the only unionized carrier, we again face the risk of, you know, losing membership, or because of the uneven playing field, right? And so because Deutsche Telekom is represented, Germany has very strong unions. They are almost, they're like high 70% organized. And so CWA reached out to Verdi, which is the German union, and talked about, hey, you've got these workers in the US who are at T-Mobile, which is owned by Deutsche Telekom. You don't want to see your union density diminished if they can get away with it in the US by not having workers, unionized workers. What's to say they won't attempt to do that in Germany? So, you know, it's in our best interest for us to try and negotiate an agreement with Deutsche Telekom to be neutral in the United States when CWA attempts to organize those workers.
Did we succeed?
We did not.
Now, you were in Germany and you spoke to the CEO of Deutsche Telekom. Did you also speak to a convention or a meeting of Verdi folks?
I did not speak to the they didn't have a convention, but we went to call centers in Germany and I got to meet with the workers there and learned they don't have productivity measurements. I mean, they were talking 1979 Bell system. No, it was just a much more relaxed environment. They couldn't be fired, but they did have their pay attached. So if my standard is 98%, then I'll get my full pay if I meet that standard. If I drop to 95%, it's going to affect my pay. And I can't at this moment remember how much, but that's how they tried to keep the workers meeting their objectives.
And did you go with frontline service reps to those call centers?
I did. Yes, and with some of the officers of Verdi and the two people that Otto and Steven, who were involved with CWA and trying to negotiate the neutrality agreement.
And that was quite a attempt to have worker-to-worker, service-rep-to-service-rep relationships or learnings across Germany and the U.S.
There were occasions where the workers in Germany would come to the U.S. There were attempts in, I'm trying to think, Albuquerque, New Mexico had a T-Mobile call center. And they had an organizing committee and were trying to get people to sign cards, even though we didn't have a neutrality agreement or anything. And some workers from Germany would come to that. There was one there and one in Kansas. And they would come there and they would meet with the workers and talk about their conditions and why it was so beneficial to be represented by a union. So there was a lot of back and forth with call center workers in the U.S. and Germany.
I remember when the merger between the T-Mobile buyout of Sprint was before the regulators, and we were trying to launch a multifaceted campaign to block that merger as anti-competitive. There was a meeting of the board up in Seattle, and they visited a T-Mobile call center. Did you happen to go to that?
I did not, no.
Well, I'm going to tell a story then. Lothar, or who was the other one? There were two of them who were key people.
Otto Wilhelm and Stefan Hageman.
Yeah, and Stefan. Yeah. Those are the two. And then there was a female, and I can't think of her name.
I can picture her, though.
Yeah, it's great.
But Otto, I think, was the one who sat on the board.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's right.
So he came on this board meeting that was being held in Seattle. And he had asked that when they go to visit the call center, a couple of the members of the organizing committee be that they speak with them. And so they're going through the call center, the Deutsche Telekom board, and it's a huge call center, 1,000 people or more. An announcement comes out for these individuals to come to the front. And so all the workers in the call center saw the clout of these CW organizing committee people who got to come up and talk to the board members. I remember that
Oh, that's
very
great.
clearly. Anyway, I think we're ready to move on from that. Unfortunately, the T-Mobile campaign, once the Sprint merger was approved, our leverage and that strategy, unfortunately, it was decided was not moving forward. I think I've come to the end of my questions. What have I missed, Brenda? What would you like to add?
So I will just add that we are so fortunate to have an organization like CWA, and we're so fortunate to have the people who have dedicated their heart and soul to the labor movement. And it's one of the proudest things in my life to have been a part of CWA, from membership to a leadership position. And I'm just so excited that this is going to be preserved, and that when people are asking questions, I used to worry that someday when my granddaughter was growing up and she'd look at me and instead of saying, why a labor movement, she would say, what is a labor movement? And we have to continue to fight, and we have to continue to advertise how great it is to be part of the labor movement, how great it is to have a voice, to have the advocacy that unionism brings to our country.
What do you think about the current upsurge among young people of
Oh,
interest in
it's
unions?
so exciting. It's so exciting. And what the UAW is doing, I'm just so proud of all of the work that's been going on there. It gives me hope. And if you look at history, you will see when we have a more balanced in country, when we have more people who have a say in how things are done, we have much more unity, we have less divisiveness, and we have a much more productive, healthy environment. And so to see that coming back, is just so up, it just gives me hope and optimism. I just hope that what's coming in the next few months doesn't do anything to derail it. I'm disappointed that people are not giving Joe Biden his due, especially in terms of what he's done for working people. He may not look the part of a great leader, but he is a great leader, and he's got the people around him who know what the priorities are and know how important the working men and women of the United States are to this country.
Jeff, your turn.
You've had like this incredible career with CWA. I mean, going from shop stewards, strike, local officer, a number of different local officer jobs, staff, and finally to the CWA executive board. So I've got this magic wand right now. I'm going to make you president of CWA. And I'm going to give you 2/3 of all of the CWA delegates will vote for whatever you want in terms of making a change at CWA. So what would you do to change our union right now if you had that power?
Oh man. One thing.
One thing. Big thing, little thing. You've got it. 2/3. I'm going to vote for whatever you say.
Restructure the board.
How would that look?
I think it would. I think I would place more emphasis on organizing and legislative and political work. The bread and butter of our union is the representation and contract negotiations. We can't lose sight of that. But if we don't change the laws, if we don't work to organize, then that bread and butter group is going to get smaller and smaller and smaller. What about you?
It's not fair. This is your turn. Had my shot. I didn't do it. I didn't get it done. I got a few
You did
things
a
done.
great job.
I got a few
You
things
did.
done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're great.
So,
Yep.
yeah.
Well, you did a great job.
You did
What about
many
you, Deb?
things.
I'm not going to join into that
Yeah.
conversation because you all were elected leaders. You understand the pressures going on. Hannah?
Sure. I have a couple questions. First of all, what are Bunsen singles?
Oh, okay. Bunsen singles is a, of course, baseball reference. It was the name of the program that was established to look at service delivery at US West.
And you met your husband through that?
So, yes, we were both union representatives on a labor management committee that oversaw the process, the Bunsen singles process. And he was a local president in Arizona, and I was a support person in St. Paul. And we started working together on this project, and it took us all over the district, which is 14 states west of the Mississippi. And in doing the work, we got to know each other and developed a relationship. We fell in love and got married.
Thank you for clarifying, because I thought Bunsen singles was some kind of matchmaking service that I'd never heard of. Like you get the singles together and the sparks fly like a Bunsen burner and then they fall in love.
No, but I've been looking for something to do. Maybe I'll start
It's a great name. Copyright it. Give me 10%.
that. Yes,
All the technicians who need a.
no kidding.
My other question is about the 83 strike. You described it as like this amazing environment and that you brought snacks and played songs. And I'm wondering, what were the snacks? What were the tunes? Can you like paint me a picture of a day on the picket line in 83? Who was
Oh,
there?
sure.
What was it? What was the weather like? You know, what was the mood? What were the chants?
So our contract expired in August. So the we went on strike in August in Minnesota. So it was hot and humid. And so we'd bring tents, like just pop-up tents, so people could step into the shade when they weren't walking through the parking lot. We were allowed to go through the parking lot. A lot of times the company will say, get off our property, but we were able to walk through the parking lot. And we would have, like in the morning, we'd bring donuts. In the afternoon, we'd bring popsicles. We had cookies and just, you know, everything we could think of that people would like that they could eat while they were walking a picket line, water, sodas, things like that. And then we'd play some union songs like Solidarity Forever. And then we just play the hits of the day. So whatever was popular in the 80s, just anything to keep the energy up and to keep people moving, you know, and we'd dance around with our picket signs and do things like that. Try and get people to honk when we were walking, so when cars drove by, get people to honk as a show of solidarity to the strikers. That always was a real pick-me-up for them.
And what were was the music coming out of like a boombox?
Yeah, we had a boombox.
And what were the songs of the day? Do you remember?
I don't remember what was big in the 80s. You probably weren't even born then. Jeff, Debbie, what was big in the 80s?
Can't even tell you what's big now. It's big in the 80s.
How many Is that
people were
Disco Disco Duck? I think, wasn't
could
it?
be. Could be.
The, like Donna Summer and the Bee Gees.
Yeah, probably right.
How many people were on the picket line?
So at the location I was at, we would have shifts of like 4 hours, and we do 3 4-hour shifts. We quit at over We didn't do overnight, and there were usually 25, 30 people.
And what did the sign say?
On strike against US West.
To the point. Okay,
Yeah.
thank you for entertaining me. I just wanted to know a
Yeah.
little bit more about that.
You can see
Sure.
that Hannah is picturing recreating this, which is really important.
Yeah.
As well as being an artist, Hannah, you're a journalist too. Were members getting strike pay?
Nope.
Oh,
We did
okay.
not in 83 we did not. There was a $50 hardship if you applied for it, but no. But then in 98 we did. And in 98 it was nice because jobs were so plentiful and we had a lot of people who had just started. And so they could go and get a job making $10 an hour, which was more than they were making at starting wage at the phone company.
I have one last question. As I recall, District 7 really took to Larry Cohn's mobilization tactics and strategies, but you guys hit a roadblock at one point. The Black Armband Agreement. Can you talk about that?
Yes. In Denver, this happened in Denver. They were protesting a company policy, and I don't remember all of it. Anyway, they were told to stop. They didn't. They continued, and then they appeared with black armbands. The company filed an injunction, took them to court. Took CWA to court, took us to court, I should say, and the injunctions prohibited some forms of mobilization as a supplement to that. And so anything that can be resolved through the grievance process, you cannot mobilize around.
And that continues to this day with
To this day.
whoever it is that bought Quest and
Yes.
so we've talked a lot in these interviews, and Jeff talked a lot about his local at Ohio Bell for a long period did not have a grievance procedure. So they did all kinds of what they
Well,
didn't then call mobilization activities.
we had a grievance procedure. We didn't have arbitration.
Thank you for correcting me. But he talked about how this developed solidarity and militance and impact. What impact did it have that you couldn't do mobilization around anything that could be grieved?
So it had a big impact, and it was very frustrating for the members because they didn't understand it, why we weren't mobilizing, mobilizing, mobilizing. And so we had to get creative, and we were still able to mobilize things that around things that were not grievable. And so it wasn't taken away from us totally, but it just curtailed the work that we could do.
So you'd have to find something that wasn't grievable and mobilize around
And
that.
mobilize around that.
Okay. It isn't how I want to end this conversation. I want to end it a little bit how you were ending it. What difference did it make in your life to be so active and part of CWA?
When I got active, I felt like I had found my family. The embrace that I felt was like nothing I had ever felt before. And I was always active. I was a Girl Scout leader. I was a soccer coach. I was active at church. I had a great circle of friends. So I was always active. We were always doing something, but there was something about the environment that was created and the sense of purpose that I felt when I was active with CWA and still feel to this day that the union is my family. The advocacy that we were a part of, having a union job, you know, I could send my kids to college. I don't know that I could have done that had I not had a good paying union job. There are just so many elements. I found the love of my life. So, I mean, they're just, I too many to count, too many to count. But I'm very fond of unions, and I am always advocating for that. I am forever telling stories, and it's just been a game changer in my life.
Brenda, thank you so much. This was very inspiring and moving, and I'm so glad we have this now on tape.